Welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. Today, I've got my fellow consultant, Rob Burtman, joining us for the show. How you doing, Rob?
Hey, everybody. Yeah, doing well. Doing well. How are you? Are you getting any sleep?
Yeah, doing real well. I'm glad I kind of waited a couple weeks to record this, post-election podcast, you know, because like right after the election, like day of or day after, right? We still didn't know really exactly who won yet. Unless you're Nate Silver, right? He was saying on Twitter, like he already knew basically Biden won, like once he could see how many mail ballots were outstanding. But we have a little more clarity now. So I thought we'd have some fun and talk about what President Biden might do to student loans and what impact that might have on our audience. So Rob, are you a political junkie at all or not really?
Not until this year. I'm not apolitical, but I never really paid much attention to it. But obviously it's been such a fascinating time. So I haven't been getting as much sleep. I've listened to like 7 or 8 different political podcasts over the last few months. It's been fascinating for sure.
I've always been fascinated by the process. So I actually like have been following 538 for a long time. And I used to watch, you know, like CNN horse race kind of stuff with the primaries ever since 2004. I mean, that's kind of the first time I remember really closely following things. And in 2008, I followed it even more closely. But I remember, you know, the Howard Dean scream. I'm yeah. Old enough to remember that at least. Let's see. I remember the Obama Clinton face offs and the debates and, you know, you're likable enough, Hillary. And I remember, you know, all those kind of key moments in history, right? In political history. I remember the Romney stuff, like in Iowa. I think one time he spent like an average of like $200 per voter to win Iowa, I think, in one of the contests. I don't know. It's real interesting stuff to follow the horse race and kind of make predictions.
The first election that I voted in was the 2000 election, the Gore Bush election with the hanging chads. That was my first time I could vote. I think I was 20 at the time. And I was a sophomore in college. I was like, what the heck is going on? You know, Florida, your home state, right? You were living there. And I'm sure it was all over the news there at the time. But the hanging chads and how long it was drawn out. And I just remember, you know, actually what I remember the most is Saturday Night Live at the time. Will Ferrell was playing George Bush and they had Daryl Hammond playing Al Gore. And the skits that they came up with for the two of them throughout the debate stuff and like the post-election stuff was just absolutely hilarious. So I like the humor part of all that stuff as opposed to like the actual politics at the time.
Well, I remember like Saturday Night Live with the Tina Fey, Sarah Palin impression. I feel like that really moved the dial quite a bit towards the Obama Biden ticket because I just remember so many people couldn't distinguish between Tina Fey and Sarah Palin in terms of, you know, things they said. So while I can't see Russia from my house, I can read the websites out there and get some kind of ideas about what might happen. So it's 48-48 in the Senate. As we're recording this, they haven't called North Carolina and Alaska officially yet, but it's kind of presumed that those are pretty safe bets to go Republican. So then it would be 50-48, and the vice president has the deciding vote of controlling the Senate if it's a 50-50 tie. And so we've got two Georgia Senate seats coming up. That would be January 6th, which notably is after the student loan interest freeze expires, which is kind of interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And those two seats are going to decide who controls the Senate. If Democrats win both of them, they'll control the Senate. If they win one of them, they will not. That's really kind of an interesting situation. The reason I want to start off talking about just control of the Senate is because it will make a big difference on student loan policy in the next 2 years. So let's just get, so I did some research, Rob.
You did research? That's hard to believe.
I know. So, I'm just curious, kind of like, and this, you know, this is just sort of to frame the discussion of like what might happen with student loan policy. But I looked up 2008, where President Obama ran against John McCain, and President Obama almost won Georgia then. It was like 49-47 back then in favor of McCain. And I think the Senate race was very similar, basically 49-47. And so that Senate race in Georgia went to a runoff. And the runoff election, the Republican had a 2-point margin, which is basically what one of the candidates had, you know, the one that wasn't running with 20 different candidates in the race. Ossoff versus, I think, Purdue or something like that. And anyways, the race margin in the runoff election was 57% for the Republican to 42% for the Democrat. So it's kind of really fascinating. I thought that the general election was a 2-point margin of victory for the Republican, goes to a runoff, and then that Republican won by 15%. So I think that based off of that, they're saying that, you know, unless there's sort of a turnout miracle, it seems as if Republicans would have a very high chance of capturing one of those two seats. So that's why I think a lot of the national media has been almost kind of talking about a Republican Senate majority as a foregone conclusion, mm-hmm. just because of those runoff numbers from back in 2008. not guaranteed, of course, but it seems more likely than not that there will be a Republican Senate. And if there's not, then the arch progressive Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia would be the deciding vote in the Senate. I'm making a joke. You know, Joe Manchin is like the most unexpected senator in the Senate in terms of like how, you know, his state voted 70% for Trump and 30% for Biden. And yet this guy still has a Senate seat as a Democrat, which is just kind of amazing, you know? Mm-hmm.
I think in West Virginia, I looked at the map. There were no counties that were a Democratic majority, like no counties in West Virginia. It was all red counties.
Yeah. And, you know, I met one of the smartest guys I knew at college was from West Virginia. He was a computer science whiz, really smart guy. And, you know, I'm sure there's lots of smart people in West Virginia. Most people in West Virginia, though, are not the PhD college educated types, right? It's white working class. That's why Trump won such a huge margin of victory, because that's his base. So if you think about Joe Manchin representing his state, you know, he would be the 50th vote on any kind of student loan reform bills if the Democrats did retain the majority. And you would imagine that he would not necessarily be raring to, you know, just super excited about passing expanded student loan forgiveness bills and things like that with a state that's so heavily working class that would not really care about that too much. Mm-hmm. So I think that even if you did have a 50-50 Senate, I think that, you know, student loans would not necessarily be a priority animating issue for the Senate, no matter who ends up controlling it. So that's part of this discussion that I wanted to frame. So given that we have, you know, a President Biden who is probably going to carry on the Obama-Biden policies on student loans, right? Certainly, you know, maybe you could look at it as those policies plus more of a progressive tint to it, because you do have a lot more powerful progressive wing in the Democratic Party now. So I'm going to read kind of seven key things that I've written about on the site that might happen or that President Biden might try to achieve. We can kind of talk through each one of them. So the seven are bankruptcy discharge or allowing it, expanding forgiveness with new forgiveness plans, reducing what people can pay on IDR, increasing Pell Grants is number four. Five is eliminating taxes on forgiven loans. Six is forgiving undergrad debt and making college free. And seven is canceling somewhere between $10,000 to $50,000 for all student loan borrowers. So let's work through each one of those. So can you explain what a bankruptcy discharge on student loans is and what, you know, why it's not legal now, and what your thoughts are on maybe having that become something that people could do?
Sure. So student loans, if someone has to declare bankruptcy, personal bankruptcy, student loans have a very, very low chance of getting forgiven, especially federal student debt and private student debt. You know, no matter what someone's financial situation is, they can get rid of credit card debt, they can get rid of car debt, they can maybe get rid of their mortgage. I mean, at great cost, because you can't just, you know, you have to give up the asset too. But student loans, have been very little precedent for forgiveness in bankruptcy. I know Lauren just wrote an article about how there was one case that looked promising, but all in all, there's really no escape. Like with student loans, once you have them, you can't get rid of them, even in the most dire financial circumstances. You know, bankruptcy law is pretty complicated. I'm not a bankruptcy law expert. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a tax professional. But I can tell you that I would think that to pass something like that would be unlikely, because I don't see Congress rewriting bankruptcy laws to accommodate, you know, just to add in student loans. There might have to be some other bankruptcy law reform. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, I always get kind of a little amused how like the average person on the street's kind of like, you know, Mitt Romney is a flip-flopper, right? Because he was pro-choice and then he was pro-life or something, right? Or Kamala Harris is the most liberal senator in the United States Senate or something. And then therefore that predicts how she'll act as vice president. Neither one of those takes are correct. And same thing, Joe Biden was the senator from Delaware, was very much a strong proponent of making bankruptcy difficult to do, because Delaware's the capital of a lot of businesses and credit card companies, right?
Finance companies, yep.
Yeah, and so people look at what people's positions were as senators or some other state, like a governor of a specific state. And what people have to realize is like politicians' jobs is to represent the place where they're from. And when you're president of the United States, you have to represent the entire United States, right? When you're, you know, senator from California, obviously that person probably should be one of the most progressive senators in the Senate, because California is one of the most progressive states in the country. You know, a Mitt Romney from Massachusetts is going to have to look different than a Mitt Romney that's trying to represent, you know, the broad Republican Party nationally. Just as those things are true, I think that Joe Biden is going to be more leaning into the progressive view of this as a president because he's supposed to represent, you know, the mainstream of the Democratic Party instead of the views of the credit card companies in Delaware, which might have a huge influence on a senator from Delaware. So I think that Joe Biden will be very much in favor of making bankruptcy a lot easier to obtain on student loans. The reason it's not is because student loans are unsecured credit. Mm-hmm. So if you made student loans completely unsecured and made it easy to discharge them in bankruptcy, that would make the required interest rate that people would need to have on student loans very, very high. And so that would be a reason why I don't necessarily think that this might happen, at least in a broad sense. Now, they could make it a little easier to do bankruptcy discharge, but with a Senate, you know, and we're just going to assume for the purposes of this podcast that it's a Republican Senate just because it's easier to say that than 50-50 tie plus, you know, VP deciding the vote. So I think that bankruptcy discharge law is not going to change all that much. I think that you're going to see something similar, and maybe you'll get like some clarifications where, you know, at least it's more of a streamlined process to apply for bankruptcy discharge. But as of now, you know, you have to prove that this undue hardship where it's just like it's impossible, you have zero chance of ever paying this back. It's not just that it would be difficult, it's that you have to prove impossibility. So that's very hard to prove from a legal sense. So I don't think that bankruptcy discharge is going to get a lot easier for folks out there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point because it is unsecured debt that people issuing private student debt or even federal student or the government issuing federal student debt, they're taking on a lot more risk because if it can just be discharged, then, you know, 1 in 4 people with student loans are in default right now or something like that. Imagine 25% of the student debt being discharged out of bankruptcy. You know, you'd have to see student loan interest rates go up into the teens, maybe, I would think.
Yeah, and I don't want to say that we're not sympathetic to borrowers. I mean, that's our job, is to be sympathetic to borrowers, right? We just want to explain to people. Like, I get this statement, I'm sure you've heard this all the time, Rob. They say, I can get a mortgage for 3%, so why is my student loan at 7?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I hear that all the time. Now, you know, if you're a dentist, yeah, that's a higher credit risk than you're really actually subject to. You're giving student loans to the person in America on average. And on average, if you look at what private student loans go for, those interest rates tend to be in the 10 percentile range. And that's with a cosigner, a decent creditworthy cosigner, just because, you know, your average private loan person is the average person in America. So, you know, your 600, 700-ish FICO score, maybe a middle-class income, right? That's who you're calibrating the student loan program to. And so with 6 or 7% interest rate on student loans, that as a private loan would be like a, you know, 8, 9, 10% interest rate. And that's with the existing bankruptcy code that makes it difficult to discharge student loans. So without that, I think you would see private student loan interest rates be more like credit card interest rates of, you know, 15, 20%. And then that would be really difficult to obtain credit. So I don't think they're going to do a whole lot on that. So let's maybe move on to number two, which is they have discussed expanding forgiveness programs. Specifically, Joe Biden talked about making a new plan where you could have forgiveness happen in 5 years instead of 10. And a lot of people get real excited about that until you look at the details, right? So the details said that you would get $10,000 of forgiveness for each year of public service up to $50,000 total by the 5th year. Now, that's his campaign idea. The Democrats in the Senate proposed basically having PSLF have a 50% forgiveness after 5 years, and then the other 50% gets forgiven at the 10-year mark. So theirs was more of a keep the existing PSLF in place, but make it so that you could get a lot forgiven after just 5 years instead of 10. So what do we think about those programs? I mean, do you think that those could potentially impact PSLF as is, or what are your thoughts on the chances that passes?
I mean, to me, that could be really impactful because, you know, if the average borrower has somewhere between $30,000 and $40,000, you know, if they worked in public service for 3 or 4 years, they could be debt-free with the $10,000 a year. The rub is that, okay, so we have the Republicans who, under the current political climate, they're not going to make any concessions to work with Democrats. And then Biden also has the progressive side, you know, the AOC, Bernie Sanders, the people who are sort of the leaders of that movement, and Elizabeth Warren, they might be asking for more. So you have some people who want to do more than that, and you have some people who don't want to do any of that, trying to negotiate this type of forgiveness. PSLF in its current form is pretty advantageous, but it's not as wide-reaching. And I'd like to see, you know, be more wide-reaching. But I think this is obviously more likely than bankruptcy. And I think it could be more effective because, like I said, you could have people get rid of their student debt within 5 years instead of 10. That could really catapult people into like much more solid financial footing. So I think it would be a good program to do. Costly, but probably effective.
Yeah. And if you look at compromise, you know, you can look at the PSLF program and it's going to start costing tens of billions of dollars a year fairly shortly because the bills are going to finally start coming due because they didn't set money aside for this ahead of time. So all the money that has to be paid is going to start popping up kind of out of nowhere. And so there's going to be a lot of pressure on the PSLF program when that starts to happen. And I think that the other thing is if you look at, you know, people always say, well, PSLF, they want to take away forgiveness from teachers and firefighters and police officers. Well, that we know that that's not the case. When you change PSLF, you're really taking forgiveness away from lawyers, physicians, people that are high debt, high income. That's who's really getting the biggest benefit. So I think that what you might see is this $10,000 per year for up to 5 years of forgiveness for public service. I think that that could end up becoming a compromise piece of legislation where they would replace the existing PSLF program that's unlimited forgiveness and do away with that and completely in favor of this, you know, limited 50,000 total forgiveness. Now, obviously, we know that that would not affect current borrowers. I would say that that's probably not as likely as just status quo. I actually think the status quo is much, much more likely than that. But, you know, first of all, I think PSLF borrowers have to be feeling great after this election because static sort of divided government is great for the status quo, right? I mean, you can talk about compromise, but in general, like there's not tons and tons of compromise anyway. You know, when you have divided government and in this hyper-partisan environment, you know, there's kind of a honeymoon period right now where, you know, if you look at some of the language from the Republicans that have accepted Biden's victory, they're saying, you know, he deserves a cabinet as long as the people are not too radical and all these things. I mean, you know, that's not exactly too honeymoonish, but, you know, I mean, but at least it seems like people are willing to work together a little bit. And then, you know, you kind of have a year where you might see things happen. And then the next year is all going to be focused on the election. It kind of seems like it's that way every year.
Yeah.
You know, in new forgiveness programs, I think the only way you would see them happen is if Republicans agreed to something new in exchange for limiting or curtailing something that already exists.
For sure. Over the last 4 years, there really haven't been any changes to student loans at all, aside from the payment freeze, which was a bipartisan agreement, which was extended by Trump through the end of the year. So that to me shows that, and just like we've talked about many times, but the history of student loan repayment, federal student loan repayment has gotten more and more accommodative, no matter who's in office and who is in control of the Senate or the House. I agree with you that current borrowers are probably protected under the current rules, and it could only get better from here. But future borrowers might, like you said, they might have to use this as a negotiation. The Republicans might say, if you give up PSLF for new borrowers, then we'll give you this shorter term, less costly forgiveness.
Yeah, we'll come back to that point in a second. So reducing IDR plan payments. So Biden campaigned on reducing payments from 10% of income to 5% of income for 20 years, presumably with no tax bomb. Now, it seems like he might have meant for undergrads only because he never explicitly like designed his plan for undergrads, grad students. He didn't have that level of detailed policy like maybe Secretary Hillary Clinton did when she was running for president, where everything was a lot more detailed, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's the chance that that happens?
I think it's unlikely. I think it's a starting point for the Biden administration to negotiate. But to me, this is by far the most costly part of the plan because you're cutting everyone's payments in half compared to pay or repay. And then you're also getting rid of the tax bomb, which for six-figure borrowers, I mean, the cost of paying back loans goes down to about a quarter or something like 20% or a quarter of what it would be compared to pay if you include the payments plus the tax bomb. And the other thing is that it doesn't really solve the problem because it doesn't make going to school free, but it makes the cost of going to school so infinitesimally small. I just think the cost of education would skyrocket if this went through under the current proposal, which I think is bad for everybody because it's bad for people who can't get access to the amount of federal loans that they need. And it also costs the government and the taxpayer a ton of money on the back end of it. It's ambitious. You know, I think getting rid of the tax bomb alone is probably more likely than getting the 5% payment plus getting rid of the tax bomb.
We will have to say that the pay and repay programs happen because of executive orders. You know, those executive orders happened because they couldn't agree on legislation to reauthorize the Higher Education Act, which is supposed to happen every 4 to 5 years, and we're 12 years overdue. It hasn't been updated since 2008, approximately. So you could see Biden coming out with a new executive order on IDR plans that maybe makes a new plan or tries to simplify existing plans. But I don't think that necessarily that would happen right away or be, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's hard to predict that, but, you know, it would seem like the same Vice President Biden that was involved in the administration that passed repay, right? At the very end of the Obama-Biden administration, they passed repay via executive order. Mm-hmm. Now, you could say one reason they did that was to get everyone access to a cheaper plan. But another thing they did in that plan was they made it that so that you could not file taxes separately and pay less money. Now, why did they do that, right? Why did they also ask for 25 years until forgiveness instead of 20? The reason they did that is because I think that they knew that high-income people were paying a lot less on their loans, and they don't necessarily want that, mm-hmm. right? So I do actually think that that kind of campaign proposal is something that is really targeted at getting votes from people that are going to undergraduate programs. I don't think that they necessarily want to drastically cut the amount that graduate school professionals pay on their loans. So that would be something that I would not anticipate changes that would make people go to for forgiveness just way more than they already are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that that's going to change too much. But you know, I could be wrong. So number four is increasing Pell Grants. This is kind of a big deal because it would be really expensive because you know they campaign on doubling the available Pell Grants for school. I mean, some of the education proposals were a little duplicative though because they also talked about making college free for undergrads that went to public universities. So we'll talk about that in a second. But you know, increasing Pell Grants, you know, I don't know, Rob, this is maybe the one that we're less highly experts in, but it seems to me like that wouldn't necessarily happen to that degree with the Republican Senate.
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, one of the most important things when people are talking about racial and social equity is access to education, access to affordable, high-quality education. And like, for example, in the Biden-Harris plan, they're also talking about universal pre-K for 3 and 4-year-olds too, because high-quality early childhood education can help close the gap on everything. I think that expanding Pell Grants would be sort of an easy win for people who don't have the means to send their kids to college without taking out loans. It would be a win for people who have a lot of working class or lower income families in their constituency that, you know, they could say, hey, we're providing access to education more readily available. That could be something that could be thrown in. I don't see it as like a flag in the ground sort of piece of the legislation for student loan reform, but I do see it as something that could be thrown in.
Sure. And five is limiting taxes on forgiven loans. So, you know, obviously you have to pay income taxes on forgiven debt if you're going through a private sector route towards 20 or 25 year forgiveness. Now, I actually had a conversation with a Republican member of the House of Representatives about this. And I asked him, one, how aware are you of this problem that's developing? And two, you know, is there any chance that you think Congress will do anything about it in the next few years? And his response was essentially, we know that it exists. And the environment is very partisan, and it's difficult to do much of anything in a highly partisan environment where everyone's jockeying for position. And I'm sure he had more to say that he wouldn't be able to say because, you know, who knows, there's somebody with a tape recorder there, right? But I thought that was really interesting because essentially what they're saying is it's a bargaining chip. They didn't address this in the prior legislation because they know that having student loan forgiveness be taxed, that's a wonderful thing to be able to get rid of by somebody at some point, right? So if you're a Republican, you have power, you get rid of it. Well, that's really makes you really popular. You know, alternatively, if you're not in power and the Democrats are trying to make student loan forgiveness more generous or cancel student debt, well, maybe you trade that for something else that you want to get, maybe even on another issue entirely. So that's the kind of way I view that. I think, you know, maybe, you know, they could try to influence the IRS to issue a ruling that says, you know, it's not taxed. But I think that that's highly unlikely without legislation, right? I don't think that the Biden administration really has that much power over the IRS, which kind of is a little bit more independent than a lot of governmental agencies.
Right. And over the next 4 years, even 4 years from now, there's not going to be a big wave of the taxable loan forgiveness just because the income-driven plans haven't been around for all that long, right? Not long enough to get there. You know, they might write it into a new plan if they come up with a new repayment plan. I don't know if this is going to happen over the next 4 years. This could be something that we don't really get to until 2028 or, you know, 2032 when we get those first waves of taxable forgiveness coming in.
Absolutely. So number six, forgiving undergrad debt and making college free for all 4-year public universities and community colleges. This is kind of a fun one to me because no matter which way you cut it, they drastically understated the cost of this when they were campaigning. College is expensive, right? Mm-hmm. People saving their 529s for, over a decade to send their kid to college, and President Biden set on the trail something in the order of, well, we can make college free for $150 billion, you know, over 10 years. And then his team immediately came out and said, no, that's actually incorrect. It would be $300 billion over 10 years. And if you made public college free without any kind of regulation or limitations, then we know that it would probably be $1 trillion over 10 years because they would adjust the pricing accordingly, right? So I think that that is completely unlikely to happen regardless of what happens in this Georgia Senate election. I think that at the very most, you would take that desire and see that proliferate in other parts of the things he wants to do, like increasing Pell Grants, for example. You know, that might be a way that you could address that desire. Maybe you try to cancel a little bit of student debt because he did want to say that he wanted to forgive all debt accrued from people from undergraduate programs. So we'll talk about that, I guess, in a second. But I mean, do you agree with that? I mean, do you think that there's any chance that they forgive student debt completely and make college free?
I doubt it. There are pluses and minuses, right? Again, going to the colleges and universities, part of the reason that some of the maybe the Ivy League schools or like a Stanford or schools that can increase their tuition at a faster clip is because there's always going to be a subset of wealthy families that can afford to send their kids to school wherever they want to go. And so, you know, you have the higher academic institutions being able to increase their tuition at a faster pace than maybe a state school in Ohio or something like that, or Florida, you know, like where you and I, the states that you and I grew up in. This would be extremely costly. You don't want to give colleges and universities the incentive to all of a sudden jack up their tuition because it's free, the government's covering it, and so we can charge whatever we want. I think that sends the wrong message, especially when, you know, a lot of these colleges and universities, the major ones, have multi-billion dollar endowment funds that they're not even using to give people a break during COVID. So I think that could send the wrong message, and it would be, like you said, extremely costly to do that. So I think that's unlikely too. What I would like to see is for families who maybe a certain income threshold or below, that they would have access for reduced or discounted or free college to some extent, because then you're leveling the playing field and giving access to people who weren't fortunate enough to have a family that has the means to send them wherever their kids want, but have the work ethic, have the intelligence and the drive, or maybe they just need the opportunity, just the opportunity to get there.
Well, I mean, like with the Black Lives Matter movement and so much discussion of the racial wealth gap and, you know, stuff that we've talked about in this show, like, I wonder if that opens the door for more just direct conversations about these inequalities. I mean, you know, kind of when you're increasing Pell Grants, you're kind of beating around the bush about what the real need is, right?
Right.
Black families far more likely to have to take out high cost private student loans that hold them back even more towards retirement, achieving financial goals, being debt free. And to be honest, I mean, I've kind of discussed this on Twitter a little bit. For the payment and interest freeze that they've done, you could take a fraction of that and put it towards closing the racial wealth gap for communities of color that are student loan borrowers. And you could have, in my opinion, probably bigger impact on society in terms of equality for a lower cost than what they've done with the payment and interest freeze, which disproportionately benefits, you know, high income, high debt borrowers, which, by the way, that's you, you know, listening to this show probably, right? You obviously could fall into multiple categories, but, you know, most likely you're highly educated, higher income than average. So feel free to send the hate mail to podcast@studentloanplanner.com. But it's interesting to think about what might happen with that. Yeah, it's the one thing that I can think of is the universities kind of might make like firing squads and start sniping at each other, because I'm just thinking back when I was in Philly, right? There was this school, I think it's a private school, St. Joe's University. I think it's like a Catholic school, kind of like a place where a lot of the local people would go. Good reputation among employers in the area, but it's a private school. And I think, you know, it might cost some low to mid five-figure amount per year. And then the public schools, like your Temple University, I think that's public, I'm not 100% sure, but they would be, you know, roughly around the same cost, right? Uh-huh. And so Temple and St. Joe's and Drexel and these sort of decent universities in the area would get you to similar employment outcomes. So now imagine what would happen to enrollment at this Catholic university if the public school downtown was free instead of about the same cost, and St. Joe's was, you know, $100,000 over 4 years more than the other public school, right? So you would see one of two things. One, nobody would go to the private school, or more likely, all the people would apply to the public school and make the public school a lot more competitive, in which case you might see, depending on whether or not you're allowed to use affirmative action or anything, you know, you could see a richer, wider population at the public schools taking advantage of this if they didn't have any kind of awareness of, some kid coming from a suburban school district is going to be better prepared for college than a kid that grew up in an inner city school that's under-resourced. So it's like a well-intentioned policy, but I just don't think that you could really do that in a way that wouldn't cause really bad external things that would happen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it'll be interesting to see too, because, you know, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, I mean, she went to an HBCU, she went to Howard University, and she is a great person to really take a look at this and see how can we bridge the education divide in America. And I think it'll be interesting to see what they come up with. But this kind of goes back to the way that I kind of weigh political opponents is I look at what their platforms are, and then I look at the likelihood of them being able to implement their policies, you know, because I'm an independent voter. I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I try to vote for who I think is the best candidate, and I kind of look at their issues, and then I weigh the probabilities of what I think is likely to get done. So I think that free college and free community college is probably a non-starter, like it's probably not going to happen. But I do think, like you were saying, there might be these carve-outs to help bring families along, provide more opportunities for families who haven't really had them historically, but also making sure that we're not giving people a free pass. But like I said, it's tricky, right? Because we have the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, we have the more centrist wing of the Democratic Party, and then we have the Republican side. And given what a contentious election it's been, and even as we're going through this quote-unquote transition cycle, it's not like anyone's making any friends right now on either party. Yeah. So they got big fish to fry. You know, we got COVID, we got the economy. Small businesses are struggling, families are struggling, and they haven't even passed another stimulus bill yet as the time we're recording this.
Yeah. I mean, student loans are pretty far down on the priority list, except for they don't want to rock the boat with having a bunch of people have to make payments in a bad economy. Like, that's something that we'll talk about in a second. Mm-hmm. Number seven, the last thing I was going to talk about is the canceling $10,000 to $50,000 for student loan borrowers. So if this had been like a progressive wave election, right? If we had had Senator Jamie Harrison from South Carolina, right? Just a dominant sweep by Democrats, and you're looking at 56, 57 seats in the Senate for Democrats with this election. I do think that we would be having serious conversations of not if they're going to do that, but how much is it going to be? But in the HEROES Act, which is the bill that the House Democrats tried to pass that was $3.4 trillion back in, I think, I don't know, April, May, it was a big stimulus they tried to do. They wanted to cancel, I think, $10,000 of student debt for every American. And then they found the CBO did an analysis and that came out to about $300 billion over 10 years, which was way more expensive than they had anticipated. And that made the top line number look too high. That would make it susceptible to more political attacks, right? So they then scaled that down to say only $10,000 for struggling borrowers. And there's been discussion that President Biden could simply write an executive order and cancel $50,000 of debt for all borrowers with this, basically this section of the Higher Education Act that grants the Secretary of Education authority to waive all kinds of different terms for loans. So I've read a real interesting analysis out there that kind of says, well, the section that this in question probably actually doesn't give the Secretary of Education the authority to maybe even do what President Trump and Betsy DeVos did. You know, in other words, the reason that they allowed that to happen was because, you know, the Democrats believe that that's a section of the law that does allow them to cancel student debt. So obviously they're not going to challenge that. And then the Republicans think, well, we agree to this too, so we're just going to not challenge this. And so the real question would be, if the Republicans decided to challenge executive authority over canceling student debt, would they win? That's the real question, I think, with this. And so if they try to cancel debt with Joe Biden just sort of doing it by himself, 100% you would see a challenge that would go to the Supreme Court over this. And now the Republican-appointed judges, they have a 6-3 majority in the Supreme Court. Seems to me that that would be very unlikely that you would see any kind of for cancellation happen over this. But I could see this going to the Supreme Court. You know, that would be really interesting if they just decided, well, let's do a $10,000 cancellation as sort of a test to see if this is a power that we have, and let's run it up to the Supreme Court. But it's certainly not going to impact most of our clients.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, most of the clients that we work with, six-figure student loan borrowers, $10,000 is not going to do all that much. And even if it's $10,000, it saves maybe $4,000 on the tax bomb. And yeah, for PSLF, it doesn't save them any money. So it's kind of like, you know, employers that are doing these repayment plans where they're not thinking about the payment plan and the track that someone's on in mind. Now, I don't think maybe Congress won't get as detailed as we would with our clients about the best strategies. But, you know, if they said, let's take people who are making $60,000 or less, and let's cancel $10,000 of student debt, you know, or like anyone who has $10,000 or less or $20,000 or less, let's cancel 10 of it. To me, that would be really life-changing for those families. But, you know, if someone owes, you know, you got a veterinarian who owes $250,000, it doesn't make a difference. Like you said, if we did have that quote unquote blue wave that might have happened, that you would see the progressive wing of the Democratic Party really pushing for that 50,000 mark and maybe beyond, but we don't have that. And so the $10,000 would be nice for a lot of people who owe five figures as in student debt, but it's hard to know what's going to happen because it doesn't seem like there's any willingness to work together yet.
Yeah. So can I make a really terrible joke? So I'm a big University of Florida football fan, and they had this huge matchup with Florida versus Georgia, which is going to decide who goes to the championship for the SEC East, probably. The Florida colors are orange and blue. So, you know, they really beat down Georgia. And so I made this joke with some friends. I was like, well, it didn't end up being a blue wave, but there was an orange and blue wave. Yeah. That's a really terrible, terrible joke, awful joke. So I apologize if that offended anyone. I just wanted to say that to wake people up, because we're going to talk about refinancing now. In terms of the interest freeze, all eyes are on the interest freeze right now. I mean, everybody is trying to figure out, is Trump going to extend this December 1st? That he said he would do that in the election. Now that he's lost the election, I have to think that he would not extend it, because, I mean, I don't see any like electoral benefit to them doing that. The only thing I can think of is Senator McConnell did say that we have to do better with highly educated voters. That was one of his post-mortem comments, was that they have to have policies that appeal to the suburbs and the highly educated, affluent areas that really went towards Biden, that really delivered him the election in some regards. So, I mean, I guess I could see there being some support from Republicans if they think that's a policy that would help them appeal to highly educated people. But I don't know. I guess my kind of base case right now is that Trump would allow it to expire, and then President Biden might try to get it started up again. What do you think about that?
Right. So if it ends on December 31st, the first payments aren't due till the end of January, right? And then Biden takes office on January 20th. So it could be one of the first actions he takes is to continue the freeze, if depending on what kind of economic climate we're on. The way things are going now, you know, with COVID and with more potential shutdowns in the winter, before the transition of power, the official transition, I don't see how they could start it back up right now. I just feel like too many families are hurting. Plus, remember, you have holidays and people tend to spend a lot of money during December. So just from a consumer standpoint, you know, most people, the clients especially that I work with on the budgeting side, before they work with me, they build up massive credit card debt in December. And so imagine you have credit card debt from buying kids and family presents and doing whatever you do during the holidays. And then all of a sudden your student loans are turned on at the end of January while you're trying to pay your credit card bill. I think that pain for a lot of working class families, and even, you know, actually not even working class, I mean, every family of all income levels, that could be a disaster for families. Anyway, and then depending on where the job market is and the economy, I kind of see that they would have to extend it. Now, I don't know if Trump is going to be the one to do it if he's a lame duck president, but Biden might do it as one of his first actions in his first week in office to extend that.
The one problem, though, is the interest wouldn't necessarily just go away for the first 20 days of January if that happened. Mm-hmm. How would you like to be poor? You know, we like to dunk on Fed loan servicing all the time here on this show, right? But I mean, imagine if you're poor Fed loan servicing and they're like, oh, charge interest for 20 days. And then somebody else comes in there and says, okay, now turn it off. And then they're 10 days away from having to auto debit millions of people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I could kind of see them. The thing is they don't have to pay for it. Like, because of these executive orders and the way they've been doing it, they don't have to go out and find money to like pay for it, which makes it a lot more likely that it'll happen because they haven't been having to pay for it up front through like congressional legislation. I mean, it seems to me that this would get left out of the stimulus bill if they can agree on one before the end of the year to try to pass something. They're trying to do that. So it seems like it gets left out of the stimulus bill more likely than not. And then probably you would see Biden try to extend it to September of 2021. Now, the Democrats have never talked about extending it past September of 2021 ever yet. And if that happens, like, I would assume that basically everyone would agree to have it start up in September 2021, like on both sides, just because of how long payments and interest have been suspended. This is really unprecedented. And if we have a vaccine, you know, Pfizer announced they have an effective vaccine. If people have mostly taken that, you know, I mean, that could be September 2021. That could be a kickoff of discussing the Higher Education Act. I mean, they really could use that interest in payment starting again to be this big kickoff point to discussing that. And that's what they tried to do this past go round with Lamar Alexander being the outgoing chairman of the, you know, Higher Education Committee, or the, you know, the Higher Education Committee in the Senate. You know, he tried to do that. He basically tried to put forward a very much a policy that I think might happen if you have a compromise with Biden and the Republicans in the Senate. Basically said repay for everyone. That's the only plan. And then the standard 10-year plan is the other plan. And that's it. That was their plan. And then he had a lot of pushback on people that were filing separately for taxes, doing pay. And they said, okay, we'll let everybody keep the plan. And they already have, if they like it, which makes sense to me because that was a big flashpoint over the ACA, right? You know, you can keep your plan if you like it. And then that didn't end up being the case, and Republicans called foul on that. So I would imagine any kind of change they did with student loans would probably try to allow that to continue, just because they probably want to avoid getting blame if somebody's payments go way up.
No, I mean, I would think that they would include this in the next stimulus package, the continuation of the payment freeze, just because they did in the CARES Act. To me, it's like a slam dunk to status quo. Now, you know, there were a lot of incumbents who got reelected, and so, you know, they don't have to worry in the Senate, at least they don't have to worry about it for another 6 years. But I think it would go a long way if they did actually officially put it in the stimulus package. I don't know. Was it in the Democrats' version of the HEROES Act of the stimulus package?
It was. But see, I don't know. I would take the other side. I don't think the Republicans want to include it. I think they want people to start paying again. That's just my theory. But I think they kind of want it to start back up again. And that's why Trump did it for 3 months, because I think he wanted to leave himself a window if he did lose. Go ahead and extend it in the extension, because Republicans don't support it really that much anyway. I think the Republicans probably didn't want to do it in the first place, but they just did it because going into election, starting payments and interest on student loans for 43 million people is suicidal, like electorally.
For sure.
Right. So I think that that's the real reason why they did it. And I don't think they necessarily want to keep it going. Trump could just decide to extend it because maybe it makes people like him more. I don't know. And we know that he likes people liking him. Right. So. I don't know. It's hard to predict this one, really.
Yeah, I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, and when we were talking about refinancing, so we could kind of pivot to that. So let's just say that you were going under the assumption that they're going to turn payments back on. Well, I guess maybe we could play two scenarios, right? If they turn payments back on December 31st, you know, when should people refinance? Or if they extend it to September of 2021, when, you know, how should people refinance?
You know, if it starts up in January and we have this 20-day thing where Biden might do an executive order day one to make the interest rates go longer, I think I would see a lot of people should start applying around Christmas time, like around like Christmas, New Year's timeframe. Because remember, you have a refi deal that's good for 30 days. Once you get everything kind of signed and submitted and all the docs are good, the refi offer is good for 30 days. And so if you could get those deals all ready to go, and then you kind of see if Biden passes something in the first few days. If he doesn't pass something in the first few days of January when he's inaugurated, then nothing's happening. Because once that first payment goes out, that's it. There's no more payment and interest freeze, period. They're not going to do it again. That's kind of the free look, is that you apply and get an offer around like Christmas to New Year's time. And then you wait that 30 days just to kind of see, is he going to do something in the first few days of his flurry of executive orders? And then maybe wait up until the last second and then accept the offer, right? If you think that the payments and interest are going to start up again, then maybe you could start applying it even in early December for your federal loans, because the payments and interest freeze start. You have 30 days to wait and see. And then if you think it's going to end September 2021, which might be the most likely outcome, then you might wait and apply, you know, that same logic until, you know, September 1st is when you would start applying, you know, around Labor Day. You would start applying heavily to refinance your federal student loans. Now, one idea that I had is, when should you refinance anyway, even if interest is 0%? Because that might seem like a stupid idea, right? Refinancing and paying interest instead of not paying interest. So let me explain when that could potentially make sense. If you are worried about interest rates increasing a lot, which, you know, we've talked about in the show before, we seem to think that that's not that big of a risk. But if you were worried about interest rates increasing, if you thought interest rates were going to be 0.5% higher, in September, you might want to consider refinancing in the next few months if you're going to pay your loans back over 20 years. So in other words, if you're planning on paying your loans back over a really long period of time, then locking in something kind of low, even if you lose 0% interest for a few months, might be something that would be okay and worthwhile to do. And if you're planning to pay your loans off over a relatively short period of time, then it really doesn't matter too much if you had a little bit higher rate offered to you because you waited, because the interest is all being paid over a relatively short period of time. So just as an example, I looked up like a $100,000 refinance. If you lose out on a 0.5% higher rate for a 10-year, that costs you maybe about $3,000. And if you lose out on a 0.5% interest rate on a 20-year, but that costs you maybe about $8,000 or $9,000.
And that's total, right?
Yeah, well, that's a total interest cost. And then you have to take the 0% versus what you'd get after refinancing and look at the total cost over those few months. So in other words, from a perspective of if you're planning to pay it back over 20 years, you can make an argument that it's not that big of a deal if you refinance your federal loans a little early and give up a few months of that 0% interest on the federal loans, particularly if you saw interest rates really go up. I mean, that's something that could really happen is you get a vaccine, everybody loves divided government, the stock market stays about where it's at, people start buying cruises like they're spring break kids again. And, you know, if that all happened, I mean, the 10-year treasury, the 10-year government bond jumped hugely the other day when the market went up because of the vaccine discovery. The 10-year interest rate went up to about 1%. Well, it was down at like 0.7. I mean, that's like a 0.3 kind of increase over a relatively short amount of time. So, for, I mean, we're getting kind of technical here. For most of our readers, they just want to hear what should we do, right? So, I mean, I think if you're planning on paying back your loans in the time that we tell people to, which is like 5 to 10 years, you probably can wait. You know, you can probably can wait on refinancing your federal loans. If you're planning on paying your loans back over a really long period of time, you might want to not wait too long. You know, certainly December, January, February would be a reasonable time to refinance if you're wanting to stretch it out over a really long period of time. That's basically my thought process.
Yeah, and I would just add another layer that if your job is at all at risk, if there's another shutdown, then do not refinance.
Of course, yeah.
And so if you have predictability around your income and your job prospects, whether we have another shutdown or not, then refinancing could be a good way to go about in the strategy that you're talking about. Yeah, obviously, the shorter the amount of time you're paying over off the loan or planning to pay off the loan, the less of an impact the interest rate has.
Sure.
But yeah, just keep in mind your income variability and your prospects.
Of course. And the thing I've seen is like our medical professionals, listeners, they're rock solid. Mm-hmm. I mean, my wife had a 30% cut to her income. She lost her 401k match and all that's come back now. And so if we look at just anecdotally, the emails that I get, dentists, all these people, like incomes wise, things are fine. Like in terms of job stability. Now, I don't think we've seen a ton of hiring yet. I don't think we've seen like gangbusters, like everybody's looking for new medical professionals all over the place, pushing up wages. Like we're not seeing that kind of activity yet. Mm-hmm. But I think that there's a very low chance that anybody in the medical world has any reason to worry. Probably the legal world too. Lawyers have been telling me a lot of good stuff about what's going on with their incomes.
Yeah.
People in economically sensitive areas, business folks, that kind of stuff would be the people that I'd be a little bit most careful about. And also refinancing private loans. These are the lowest rates that I think we'll see.
Yeah, take advantage of that now.
Pretty much ever. So, you know, studentloanplanner.com/refi, lock something in. And if you've already locked something in, lock something else in because the rates are so low that virtually everybody that's applying to refinance is finding something better from one of our partners. So you get the cash bonuses. You know, there's all kinds of benefits to getting lower interest rates when you get paid to refinance instead of having to pay like you do when you do a mortgage refinance. So definitely take advantage of that. And consults, people are getting plans now. I think a lot of people must, based off of our booking data, we're just waiting to see who won the election to decide to get that plan in place. People's need of having a plan for just psychologically dealing with the burden of their loans and the anxiety that debt causes, that's something that kind of exists, it seems like, no matter what is going on in Washington. Would you say that's the case, Rob?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've had pretty steady bookings. The clarity piece, I mean, it's nice to know that you're on the optimal plan, but just the clarity piece, it seems to be very powerful for people in this world of uncertainty, which is becoming more and more certain with the Pfizer vaccine trial and now the election's behind us. And there's more certainty, and which helps people stress and anxiety, you know, no matter what side you're on. And I always tell people, like, it's never too early and it's never too late. As soon as you know what your job prospects look like once you graduate, like, get it, you know, sign up to get a plan from us. If you feel like, ah, it's too late for me, or I haven't done anything with this for 10 years, well, now's the time.
Yeah. The only lull we ever really have seems to be February and March, just because that's kind of in between people finding out they have to pay their loans and people graduating in May and June, July. But then who knows? Maybe that'll be a super busy time, because maybe they'll force people to start making payments again. And whenever that does happen, we're probably not going to have very good availability, because we can't just go out and hire 5 new consultants and make sure the quality is really high immediately. So thank you, folks, for booking plans too, just because you know that the plan's not going to really be different now versus when payments and interest start back up again. And that's when we're going to be a lot less available. So anyways, people can get plans, studentloanplanner.com/help if you know you need one. Any kind of parting thoughts, Rob, about student loans and what might happen after this election? Any parting wisdom?
I don't know. I just think with how polarizing everything is these days, I think student loan is not going to be a high priority over the next few months as the Biden administration gets started after being inaugurated. There's a lot of other pressing issues. So it might be status quo for a long time. And it might even be status quo until, you know, we're leading up to the 2022 midterm election. But there are things that could happen. And no matter what, it's always good to know what your plan is now. What's the best plan for you now? And then if anything else comes in, you know, if you're tuning into the podcast, if you're on our email list, like, you'll be up to date on everything that's happening.
Yeah, you can always make changes, right? You know, something happens unexpected, and then you can always pivot and change the plan. But it seems like the more things are predicted to change, the more they stay the same. And like I said, divided government is going to be a very powerful influence for the status quo, because we did not get a mandate really. Well, there was obviously a mandate in the election, but it wasn't like a very strong go do all these progressive policies mandate, because voters sent back at least a very closely divided Senate. And then, you know, Democrats lost some seats in the House. There's all this finger pointing going on between progressives and centrists there as to whether or not the Green New Deal should be a big part of a campaign push and free public college and those kind of things. Or if that's something that, like, I think Governor Gretchen Whitmer was saying, you know, Democrats should focus on dinner table issues, right? For the, you know, in other words, be a little bit more centrist and we'll win broad majorities kind of thing. So we'll see what happens. Just all this stuff, all this different things, you know, maybe a little anxiety inducing to look at it and try to predict how it's going to affect your wallet, but we've got you covered, right, Rob?
For sure.
Cool. Well, thank you everyone for listening. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask of me or any of our consultants, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and you can record a quick little 10, 30, second, 60 second kind of question that we'll maybe talk about on the air. And thank you so much for listening to the show. Reach out if you got any questions, folks.